newspaperman meets such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis on media issues of the day, where we look at newsroom decision making and where some local journalists apply the standards of those newsrooms to some of the big stories that you've been watching in the media across the country. I'm Rex Smith, formerly editor of the Times Union, now creating the Upstate American here in Upstate America, with my colleagues, Judy Patrick and Barbara Lombardo. Judy Patrick, formerly editor of the Daily Gazette of Schenectady. You doing okay today?
I am ready. I was born ready.
Oh, we're in trouble.
In the words of the august David Gustina, our producer,
yes.
Are we ready? I was born ready.
There we go. All right. And we have here, are you born ready also? Barbara Lombardo over in the corner of the studio here, formerly executive editor of the Saratogian and the Record of Troy.
Oh, absolutely. Let's do it.
Now we've raised expectations. All right. Here's the question. Since people in this room, in this studio, are old enough to remember Watergate, you remember the famous quotation from Senator Howard Baker, the Republican vice chair of the Watergate Investigative Committee, saying the key question is, what did the president know and when did he know it? So to paraphrase that today, the question here is, what did the reporters know and when did they know it? And the question that arises comes from a couple of instances. Here is one. We now know that in the immediate aftermath of the kidnapping of Nancy Guthrie, the mother of the host of the Today Show, of course, the kidnappers admitted that they took her, but they didn't mean for her to die, but that she had died. This was something that was not known to the public, that this was withheld by a great many news organizations. What do we want to say about this? Is this considered appropriate for journalists to withhold information in that kind of an instance?
I am furious about this because
really?
I was one of those people that was anxiously following the story minute by minute in the hopes that this poor grandmother, mother, would be found alive. And I feel incredibly misled. The excuses that the news organizations give for withholding this information as the police investigators asked them to, in part because it would dampen public interest in the story. Well, of course, because the truth can sometimes do that. And we had this elevated public interest in this, in large part because Savannah Guthrie is such a popular broadcast figure. And the other reason was that it would somehow compromise the investigation. But now, 5 or 6 months later, they are releasing it, but not as much. So what has changed in 5 or 6 months and that couldn't have happened months ago and still have kept the public informed? I just think this makes the American public trust us less because we are viewed as in cahoots with a police agency.
That is the view of Judy Patrick. Barbara Lombardo, how do you feel about this?
I partly agree with that. I do feel like we were used. The public was used and the media was used, or the media that knew let itself be used. You know, there's a Society of Professional Journalists, an organization that teaches journalists and creates standards for journalists, and they have a code of ethics that many journalists adhere to. And two of the four foundations of it are to report the news fully, and the other one is to minimize harm. And often in our business, we're trying to weigh those two factors. And so in a case like this, we know people knew that apparently she had died in the hands of the kidnappers. So do we report that fully? Who gains from that and who is hurt from that? And I tried to think of, in minimizing harm, would it be harmful to the investigation if it's known to the public that she's not there? Would it somehow hinder their ability to find those perpetrators? And nothing that I've read so far really convinces me that that is the case, which made me lean toward, like, why didn't they report the latest, back in February or whenever it was, why didn't they report that she's apparently deceased?
They, in this case, at least includes KOLD-TV, which is local, as well as CNN, which had learned about the contents of the second note through law enforcement sources at the time. I'm going to take a contrary view and say I think it's fine. I think reporters all the time come across information that they, for one reason or another, don't put into their stories. It's not relevant to the story at hand. That's one matter. It's almost important, but not quite enough. Or it's building up to a better story. You need to get more information before you have enough.
And when you say better story, do you mean for the sake of you getting the scoop?
Ah, very good question there.
Oh, Rex, your motives have been uncovered.
A better, no, a more important story. Something that if it's known, but I think here is actually a case where the withholding is more legitimate because you have law enforcement officials who probably know information that journalists don't know, saying, you know, this is what's revealed in this is information that only the kidnappers could know. If we are going to find them, we need to know who they are. You could potentially cause problems. Now, we've seen this kind of thing play out on the national scale as well. Of course, famously, the media knew about the pending invasion of Cuba during the Kennedy administration, the so-called Bay of Pigs invasion, and didn't report about it. Kennedy later said, gosh, I wish in retrospect that you guys had, because it might have stopped us from making this terrible mistake, right, if it had been illuminated. But there have been other instances where the White House has directly intervened in previous administrations where credibility was not as much a factor. You know, I don't think any of us would trust anything coming from this White House at this point. There is no measure of credibility that anyone could assign to the president of the United States now.
Well, before we follow that road down of the politics, one other thing on the Guthrie and the minimize harm is I've wondered whether if they reported that she had died and she was with nature, and like, would that have sparked people to go look for the body?
Ordinary folks?
People going to, you know,
is
trying
that
to be
a good
the
idea?
It's a terrible idea. Like, to me, that would be one of the reasons to justify not revealing it at that point.
Hmm. Well, what's the difference with the points? I mean, whatever's been released has been released now, so that whatever damage is going to happen is going to happen now. What's the difference between then and now? I'm still not convinced. Tell us what you think.
Yeah. Media at WAMC.org is how you can get to us. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this. Well, what you're basically saying then, Judy, is that you never withhold information.
No, did that. I say that?
I think she said that.
Are you Donald Trump? I did not say that. Of course there are times when you don't report everything, because almost in every story there are things that you don't disclose just because they're not relevant or because they're an issue of national security or someone's life is in danger. This was not that case. There was not a compelling reason to withhold this information. News organizations make those kinds of judgments every day. This was a huge, huge, huge story. Millions of people around the globe were following it under the mistaken impression that there was a chance this lady was still alive.
Hmm. Interesting point. So here's one that doesn't.
You just got blown off.
I know.
No, actually, I'm kind of saying, maybe she's right about that. Here's one that doesn't reach that level, but it has to do with that similar question of what do the reporters know and when did they know it? The new book, Regime Change, and now number one on the New York Times bestseller list, Maggie Haberman and Jonathan Swan of the New York Times. The subtitle is Inside the Imperial Presidency of Donald Trump. Just out now, this book looks at the first year and a half of the Trump presidency, of the second Trump presidency. And there's some revelations that we didn't know at that time. You know, for example, information from inside the Situation Room, where the questions were going on about the damage from the Epstein files, questions about the decision to invade. So bombshells, in effect, from this new book. And again, here comes the question, why wasn't this in the New York Times at the time? It was more contemporaneous. Why was it withheld for publication? Is that just to spark interest in the book? Is this justifiable on the part of the reporters?
You know, working reporters have had this issue before by Woodward's book, other books that reporters on Daily Beats encounter. And one of the justifications we have heard in the past is, well, I told you that on the condition that it wouldn't get released until the book was released. Okay, I can understand that. But the real issues, as they come around, they should have been reported in the daily newspaper. So far, I haven't read anything that would have really changed the course of public opinion about Donald Trump. I'm not that far into the book at this point. But they have to make a judgment call. I am hoping that there is a conversation happening between the reporters and the editors about what they are uncovering and what will be used where, because both of those, Maggie Haberman and Jonathan Swan, have both been writing regularly, not regularly, but occasionally for the New York Times. And so they have been writing some stories. Some of the information that's in the book is already well known. But the new bombshells that I have read so far just seem to be tidbits or like decorations on the cake, like him, you know, gluing gold leaf to the mantle in the Oval Office. Not inconsequential from my perspective. Although, and I will concede, I am not far into the book.
Right. Someone who has read the whole thing, Tina Brown, the former editor of The New Yorker, refers to it as a flabbergasting feat of political reporting.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
The alliteration alone.
Isn't that good? Isn't that very impressive? Yeah. Flabbergasting feat of political reporting. I practiced that before I went for the microphone here. In sum, she writes, regime change brings cool coherence, more alliteration, to the inferno of our times.
She's going to be on the back of that hard copy.
She needs an editor as an editor, you know?
Yeah, I want to say it's a conundrum, but it's a warning to reporters and their editors that you really need to be careful about what you're promising. And I understand that there's value in the books and that people are interested in the books and that you can learn things possibly from the books. And that to get the access, you have to make that kind of a promise that you're not going to report. And that's where the conundrum is that if you hear something in the course of your research for the book that the public needs to know, ought to know at the time, you've locked your hands. And I think that's a mistake to do that.
But we don't know that that's the case, that they promised we're not going to publish it right now. Probably there was an assumption, maybe directly so. Whoever was their source inside the Situation Room, very interesting question, right?
You know, they have a great section at the beginning of the book that explains their sourcing or how they had treated their sourcing. Most of the sources were on deep background, and they explain what deep background are. They will also say, whenever you see a direct quote, we have heard that directly from the person or from the person who directly heard it or from a audio recording. So they're very clear about how they use their sources, and they had 1,000 interviews. It could have been multiple interviews with one person.
Right. This is, of course, not the first time that even Maggie Haberman has been in this. In 2022, her book was released called Confidence Man, The Making of Donald Trump and the Breaking of America, reporting on his first term. And in that, we learned that he had said after losing the election, he recognized he lost the election. He said, but we're never leaving. I'm just not going to leave. And that is an interesting tidbit of information that if people had known it contemporaneously after Trump had lost the election, he was saying, I'm not going to leave. That might have been of relevant.
That would be
material.
A front page headline.
Yeah.
Trump declares, I'm not going to leave.
Yeah.
And it would change. It could change public opinion. It could change the nature of coverage. I mean, he has said stuff like that has been reported.
You know, what happened to the time when these kind of books were written 4 or 5 years after the person has left office? I mean, I understand that they are bigger sellers at this point, but they have such a short shelf life because this book is going to be outdated within 6 months. I mean, as historical matter, it would be interesting to read, but so much has changed. There's a section in the book about the selection of Tulsi Gabbard as, you know, Director of National Intelligence, and it's dated now. It's dated already.
Yeah. Yeah.
I do respect Maggie Haberman and Jonathan Swan both. I admire their work. I trust their judgment. In most instances, remember that great interview that Jonathan Swan did when he was with Axios and President Trump during COVID? And they're both great reporters.
They are. And I'm sure that they were in close touch with their editors. I think we've even seen the editors of The New York Times say this, that they were regularly in touch and talking to them about what could come out. And I just remember in my reporting days working on a long investigation that took months and occasionally peeling out a daily story that seemed to need to be reported at the time. But there was material that if it dribbled out, it wouldn't be very powerful, But if you amass a bunch of information that makes the same point, then you have a trend. It's like looking at the lines on a chart, on a line, you know.
Right. The story would have more impact, more depth.
Yeah.
It's in context. But it doesn't mean you wait until a book is published.
Well, yeah, I guess not. But a long project in a newspaper when the Times Union was investigating Nexium, the sex cult, that was a months-long investigation. And individual daily stories would not have served so well as the ultimate breakout, the four-part piece that ended up running and having some impact, less we thought than it should have until the New York Times picked up the story and then got the attention. But that's sort of the way of the media. But it's an interesting situation.
Bitter about that,
I'm not bitter about the fact that the Attorney General of New York and the DAs of Albany and Saratoga counties who had jurisdiction ignored this for the longest time, and that ultimately the case was brought by the U.S. attorney in Brooklyn.
Yeah, you are bitter.
Media at WAMC.org is how you can get to us. This is the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. I'm Rex Smith with Judy Patrick and Barbara Lombardo. Oh, before we leave the White House, we have to go back to this news that the White House, in fact, backed away from an effort to force reporters from the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal to testify before a grand jury about federal leaks. Now, why is this important? Well, because journalists typically do not. In fact, I cannot think of an instance where, at least certainly in my experience, a reporter is compelled by law enforcement to reveal who their source is. And here, the White House issued a subpoena for a Washington Post reporter and then withdrew it, and none of the journalists ever testified.
But don't you think that they were withdrawn because they could see the wind was not blowing in their direction for this? That would be the only reason that they would have backed down.
You know, the efforts to subpoena reporters happens a lot. I'm sure it happened in all of our newsrooms.
Yes.
And you resist it, you fight it, and there's a very good reason for that, that the public and the people who are issuing the subpoenas sometimes don't understand, is the fact that your credibility relies on the public's belief that you are an independent source of information. And if you are viewed as being working with the police agency or with the prosecutor's office, you are going to lose some of that credibility. And so for the preservation of the press as an independent organization pursuing truth independently, you have to resist those subpoenas.
What about the White House argument that this is a matter of national security, that finding out who is leaking information to the press is an effort to sustain the security of the United States? Is there an argument that makes that true?
There could be an argument, but there hasn't been a convincing one in these instances.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And there's no indication that they were trying to prosecute the reporters involved. They were just trying to identify the source of the leak and prosecute that poor soul. So we haven't reached the point yet where they are threatening to prosecute the press for reporting on information that they have published through leaks. So I am glad that they withdrew the subpoenas. I'm surprised they did. I thought that, you know, given we have seen the breaking of so many norms, the norm of not subpoenaing reporters, man, I think that's one of the things that's going to fall. We have another, 2.5 years to go.
Right. Who knows what's going to come next? Hey, there was an interesting tidbit of news that came out, news about the news media, as we were looking at some notes for this show. And that has to do with a law that limits the use of artificial intelligence before an election. Apparently,
was that Texas?
In Texas, in the state of Texas, there is a law that says that in the 30 days before an election, you're not allowed to air an ad that is generated by artificial intelligence.
Good luck enforcing that one.
Yeah, and this is in reference to the fact that there are many AI-created ads right now running through the airwaves or on the social media websites in Texas, and especially about this very highly contentious Senate race. And you're seeing the damage that AI can do and to the truth. I found it amazing that Texas has this kind of law, and I almost think that it would probably be deemed unconstitutional if challenged in court.
Probably so. And this is why there are all these questions about how AI can be used. And it strikes me that this is, call me cynical, but it seems to me that this law was probably enacted by the Texas state legislature limiting this AI into 30 days before the election so that there wouldn't be a more substantive law that would limit it at any time. Because once you're 30 days out from an election, damage has largely been done about a lot of these things. So,
you know, both Democrats and Republicans are doing this. they could both step forth and say, we don't endorse the use of AI in any of our commercials. We're not going to use it. But nobody's doing that. Nobody is disarming at this point.
And, you know, it's not just AI. It gets tricky because you can be using AI to enhance a truthful ad. And why should you be prohibited from using the tools at hand to improve your message? The danger is when they're reporting things that are totally false, and they're not only is the ad false, but it's deep fakes using videos that didn't really exist, having candidates saying things that they never said. And that's what's really dangerous to me.
There is a group called the International Fact-Checking Network, and they had their annual Global Fact Conference in Lithuania just a few weeks ago. And there is a global problem of online scams going on with AI. In the United States, we primarily think about this in the political context because that's, as we're saying, how it's being used. But it becomes increasingly difficult for people to know what's real and what's not, especially as the use of AI chatbots for news is on the rise. I was just reading the report from Nieman Lab, which is based at Harvard, and it is a journalism think tank. And they are reporting about the use of chatbots for news. Now, we're in a new environment right now because for the first time over the past year, social and video networks have overtaken news publishers as a source of news globally. And by that, I mean like YouTube and Facebook and significantly even the lesser outfits in this country. Snapchat, for example, is a news source in many countries. Now, in the U.S., it's not rising as fast, but in Asia, Africa, Latin America, Southern, Eastern Europe, the use of these social networks for news is rising quickly, and the social networks are being overwhelmed by AI. Just something else for us to worry about, I guess.
You know, some of the companies are starting to consider or agree to embed some sort of code into their programs that would automatically alert a consumer that something is AI, which I would applaud that. I think that's a good idea. Knowledge is always the best information to give people as they're viewing these kinds of things. The problem is things come at you so fast and furiously that it's hard to stop and take a hard look at anything. Once again, AI remains to me flawed, especially when it comes to news. If, you know, Google insists on giving me an AI version of whatever I'm searching for, and typically it's wrong. Typically it's summation of my email that they insist on giving me is wrong. At least it's badly flawed.
What's stunning is that even though people don't have a great deal of trust in these sources, notwithstanding that they use them as a news source,
it's good. It's considered good enough.
Yeah.
I even find myself looking at those AI summaries, and then I see
sure.
that my emails is suggesting a reply to the email. Here's what you can reply. Like, I don't have to think at all.
You know,
but you're right, Judy. They may or may not correctly be getting the gist of what is happening.
Hey, the National Enquirer used to be a very popular newspaper, and I think people bought it. A lot of people who bought it didn't believe that aliens had landed on Earth. They were just doing it for amusement. And I think that same approach may be driving our love of social media craziness at this point.
Yes, except that it's harder now to know what is true and what isn't.
Yeah. And even if something you see, you assume isn't true, it kind of registers in your brain, right? And you get an image stuck in your brain, especially images. Visual communication really creates an assumption that what you've seen is true. I think this is unfortunately going to, in years to come, lead to some astonishing First Amendment conflicts. I don't see how the First Amendment can survive unfettered with the kind of technology that intentionally misleads people so significantly. I really can't quite imagine how we're going to regulate this without doing violence to the First Amendment, but regulation is needed. So anyway, we are at the frontier of a great reckoning, I'm afraid, with information, and we're doing it at a time when the environment for the traditional news media has been so destroyed that we're going to find credibility in question at every turn. That's all we have time for at this week's
a lot,
Media
Debbie
Project.
Downer.
Yeah. All bad news all the time. Here we are from the Media Project. Barbara Lombardo and Judy Patrick, and I'm Rex Smith. We thank our producer, Dave Agostina, for making this happen, and we thank you for joining us. Hope we come back again next week for the Media Project.
They all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild. Got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill. All together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery. She wanted money to buy a new fur coat. To get insurance, she employed...
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, former editor of the Daily Gazette and former vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association, and Raga Justin, Albany bureau chief for Bloomberg Government. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
Like the richest girl who could not bake a cake. Ding-a-ling, ding-a-ling, ling-a-ling, ling. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild. Got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill. All together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give three cheers for freedom of the press.